WBEZ is supported by Rivian. Off-road electric Joyride ride-alongs are available in downtown Chicago in a Rivian truck or SUV from September 19th to the 21st at the corner of East Illinois and North Michigan. Plus, a chance to win a two-night stay at a luxury Chicago hotel. Terms apply. No purchase necessary. Entry period is September 12th through the 21st. Must be 21 to enter. Odds of winning depend on number of entries. Visit Rivian.com/Chicago Sweepstakes to enter.
America is changing, and so is the world.
But what's happening in America isn't just the cause of global upheaval. It's also a symptom of disruption that's happening everywhere.
I'm Asma Khalid in Washington, D.C.
I'm Tristan Redman in London, and this is The Global Story.
Every weekday, we'll bring you a story from this intersection, where the world and America meet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm your host, Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. As we wrap our week-long immigration series today, where we've been talking with foreign workers, international students, and permanent residents who've come to Chicago from a different part of the world to make a life here, we turn now to a conversation about the state of things for refugees and asylum seekers across the country, including here in our area. Since January, an executive order from President Trump has suspended the U.S. refugee admissions program with no end in sight. That means right now, refugees and other displaced people remain in limbo. So here's what you'll get from this conversation. One, our panel will share the very latest on the status of the program. Two, we'll hear the personal story of a Syrian woman currently seeking asylum here, and a Chicagoan who was one of the lost boys of Sudan. And three, advocates on the front lines of the battle for refugee rights will tell you what it's like to do this work under a cloud of uncertainty. At the table was Maya Oyarbide Sanchez, wellness director at Refugee One Chicago. Hina Musabji, legal director at CARE Chicago. Maria, an asylum seeker from Syria whose case had been pending for the last 7 years. The name Maria is a pseudonym. And Maketh Mobior, a former refugee from Sudan. Now, given the increased fear these days, it's been a bit of a challenge to find people willing to share their personal stories on this topic. So in order to protect their identities, several of our guests that you've heard from this week used pseudonyms or just their first name. Maria kicked this conversation off by sharing her story and why she left Syria.
My name is Maria, and I'm from Syria. I went to law school in Damascus, my hometown, and I practiced law in my home city of Damascus for several years before the Syrian war broke out in 2011. And so after the Syrian war broke out, I have witnessed lots of crimes and violence and survived war crimes. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, these tragedies affected my own immediate family, so I decided to escape and pursue my education in the United States. I have been lucky to be awarded a scholarship that was granted to 10 Syrian women to pursue their education abroad. And so I went to law school in Chicago,
right,
and earned my master's and JD program. And I'm currently practicing immigration law in non-for-profit organization in Chicago.
Well, congratulations on that, Maria. I'm struck, though, by how jarring that must have been to have experienced all that violence back home, and then have to make quite a drastic transition. What was that like for you? Were you traveling by yourself?
Yes, absolutely. I was traveling by myself. It was actually the first trip outside of Syria in my entire life. It was actually a hard decision leaving my family behind, which makes me feel guilty and like stressed all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was difficult. It was difficult. That until this day that I live in constant fear for my family's safety back home. was really a hard decision, and it was a difficult decision.
I can only imagine, Maria, and as I alluded to earlier, your case, you applied for asylum. Your case had been pending for roughly 7 years. Your request, though, just this week, I hear, was denied. Do you know why?
Well, actually, the reasoning is that there is a change, that the regime has changed, and there's no well-founded fear of persecution, that if I went back to Syria, which unfortunately dangerously misleading and incorrect because of the constant and ongoing crimes and violence in Syria, which I'm happy to brief it shortly.
So, sorry, so you're saying, is there a misconception that it should be okay for you to go back to Syria?
Yes, given the current change of the Assad regime.
But that's not the case, you're saying?
That's not the case. Unfortunately, Syria is still unsafe and unstable and extremely dangerous. We have seen lots of different armed militia are in control of Syria.
Definitely sounds like dangerous conditions persist there. And Hina, this is a good time to bring you in.
Sure.
Tell us, is Maria's case unique?
I wish I could say it was unique. The current trend in decision making amongst the department has been, we're seeing more of this. We're seeing deportation over due process. We are seeing not enough seriousness given to the laws that we have on the books to protect people who are being persecuted in their home countries. I mean, sending Maria back, how can we put that on our conscience if something does happen to her? Because she does have a fear, a well-founded fear, despite what the government is saying, for future persecution. And, it's just the rhetoric in general currently. There's just so much noise and negativity around immigrant populations. And so her case hasn't been denied outright yet.
Okay.
They've let us know that they're going to deny. So something called a notice of intent to deny.
So in this period, this interim period, is there anything you can do?
So there's a very short period, about 16 days, a little less, in which that presumption that the government is giving us that they're going to deny, we can rebut and bring forth evidence as to why she should not be.
And I assume that's what you're doing.
Yep, we're
Maria's
all working
behalf.
Together on her behalf to make sure that doesn't happen. But unfortunately, what we're seeing is this kind of, fear-mongering, making sure people are sent away, not welcoming asylum seekers. And it's just a lot of tactics that are aggressive that are being used.
This woman waited seven years.
7 years.
And has 2 weeks to appeal.
Right, at least to give a rebuttal as to why she shouldn't be sent away. And then there are other appeals processes if that doesn't work out. And, I think right now we're just seeing things unfold, and personally things that I never thought I would. I mean, just looking at things that have been happening, like Mahmoud Khalil, when he was taken, by plain clothes. You see these heart-wrenching videos of his pregnant wife, U.S. citizen wife, coming after. Like, where are you taking him, right? Rumeysa Öztürk, same thing. She lawfully, Mahmoud was a green card holder. He was a lawful permanent resident.
That's right.
Even Rumeysa Öztürk in the Boston area, she PhD student at Tufts, Fulbright scholar, right? She lawfully came to this country. And once again, you see these masked officers come take her. She has no idea who's taking her, put into an unmarked car, doesn't know why she's being taken. So,
I remember seeing video footage of that. It was alarming.
It's heart-wrenching. It's alarming. And, I never thought I would see, that kind of, that kind of fear. And,
Well, let's take a pause, Hina, because I want you to help me make sure that everyone's on the same page here. We throw around terms like refugee, asylum seeker, internally displaced person. Can you just walk us through the differences?
Sure. A refugee is someone who has been resettled in the U.S. through that U.S. resettlement program that you alluded to in the beginning. They are brought to the U.S. because of a specific humanitarian concern. That's important to the U.S., right? And they demonstrate that they were either persecuted or have a fear of being persecuted in the future. And that's due to race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership to a specific social group, right? And they're unable to receive protection in their own country. They must be living overseas. You register with the UN Refugee Agency, and then you go through an extensive process before you can come into the U.S. as a refugee. An asylee is a little bit different. You need to be present in the U.S. to apply for asylum, or come to a U.S. port of entry and invoke that. That you would like asylum. And we're seeing now, right now, the port of entry asylums. People are not even, you know, moving beyond that credible fear interview. They're not receiving due process and are being turned away.
Wow. Okay. So Maya, let's bring you in here. So you're with Refugee One Chicago. As I talked about earlier, January was when we saw that executive order come down from the president, basically saying this refugee program is suspended indefinitely. Lots of rights and protections for refugees just cut under the Trump administration. How do these moves impact organizations like yours?
Yeah, it impacts us on every level, really. From the beginning, I think what we saw right away is a huge decrease in the number of folks who were arriving, right? So, you know, the folks who were ready to travel, were going to airports, were on their way here, were turned away. And so all the folks we were expecting did not come. And then it's had a huge impact on the folks already here, too, right? I think a lot of the people and you know, going back to what Tina was saying, too, there's different status of folks who are here, but it's scary for everybody.
Yeah.
The stuff that is happening is really scary for everyone. And so folks who are already here have been afraid to live their life, really. They're afraid to go to work.
And they're also afraid at home. Tell us more about the conditions in their home country that they're fleeing from.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's an important piece I'm glad you're highlighting, because sometimes people have this misconception that people are choosing to come here for some reason that is, I don't know, enjoyable.
The American dream.
Right.
Right?
And, you know, folks are coming here. That's why we have the word forced migration, because people are forced to, right? I think we heard that from Maria talking about her story. We heard that with what Hina was saying about those definitions of why people have to leave. People are under threat and terrified, and that's why they come here. I don't think people leave their home because they want to. They don't have a choice. And that's often what we hear from folks when they come here. They might be really grateful to be somewhere when they are feeling safe.
Yeah.
But they would rather be home, right? So it's scary what's happening in people's homes, and especially when folks, like in the Refugee Resettlement Program, have already been accepted into these programs and were making plans to come here and were on that journey already here and now told they have to stay. They're staying places that they don't have an infrastructure to support them.
Right.
They have probably gotten rid of all their belongings already and are continuing to live in a place that might be really dangerous for them.
Mm-hmm. Now, Maketh, your story is one heck of a journey, right? So you fled war in Sudan. I'm just going to summarize it here because there are so many parts to it.
Yes.
But essentially, you fled war in Sudan at age 7.
Yes.
Eventually ended up at Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya.
Yes.
You spent 10 years there,
yes.
A whole decade. Eventually made your way to the United States. Do you remember that moment when you were granted asylum in this country?
It was a moment that I feel like I hit the lottery.
You felt like you hit the lottery?
Yes.
Tell me more.
Because you're living in a refugee camp where you don't have access to food, water, medicine. If you are sick, you are just there on your own trying to recover from not seeing a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So going through the process, it took us 3 years to go through the process.
The asylum process?
Yes.
Took 3 years?
It took 3 years.
Okay. About how old were you at that time?
I was 18.
Okay. Oh, wow.
When I got my exception letter, I turned 19. So I was so excited that I was given a chance to come here. The expectation was so high. I even thought that I can find money on the floor in America, but that was not the case.
Right, yeah.
But then when I left the refugee camp, all the resources that I got, I give them to some people who didn't have opportunity. So I just came here with the clothes on my body.
You didn't bring anything with you?
I didn't bring anything. It was just a luggage with the paperwork and the clothes on my body.
And so how do you adjust then? You come to this country, you have nothing. Where do you start?
Uh,
Or were you just so happy to be here?
I was so happy to be here, but I didn't know that I have to take another journey from point A to point B.
Yeah.
And if there were no people like a case manager who will show me the direction, who will take me for interview, who will take me for the ID, and then I would be still behind now. But those people opened the gate for me. Looking for a job for the first time you come here, you don't have a resume that's going to pop up.
Yeah.
You just go in there facing this somebody that you say, okay, I need the opportunity. I need to work. That's the only resume I got.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody going to believe you if they don't see a resume.
Who's going to give you a chance?
Yeah. So there was a cultural shock.
On your part, you experienced cultural shock?
Yes. Because when I was growing that day, when I talk to my mom and my dad, I have to lower my head down. I don't have eye contact. Coming here and you go for a job interview and you don't have eye contact, we're going to hire you. So this where the agencies will come in and sit next to me and say, this is a good guy. He's going to show himself. And then if you give him a chance, just opportunity to get a job. And that's what we did.
And before we pivot back to Maria's story for a moment, you mentioned your caseworker. And I want to highlight that, Maketh, for just a moment, because I learned that this was also a Sudanese person.
Yes.
How important was that in helping you transition? How did they show up for you?
I was lucky because I got one from my country that was employed by the agency. And that person was my point of contact. It will took me for filling an ID, to get an ID so that people will know me, who I am. It will take me for section security. It will take me for shopping, show me how to do shopping.
Yeah.
It will take me how to sit down in an interview and just have an eye contact. Show them who you are. That's the only thing you have because you don't have a resume. So the case managers, those are the gateway for you to fit in a society that you are to join.
So Maya, I want to hear more about your work in wellness specifically. What does that mean, especially as it pertains to this refugee service?
Yeah, well, the first thing I think of is when we hear Maketh, who was just sharing his story, the pressure that folks have when they come here, right? You're in a new place, but you need to get to work. You need to pay your rent. Mm-hmm. You need to be able to pay for food. So much is happening so quickly. And so there's a lot of support around that. And historically, that's where most of the support has been, around getting a job, which is so important. But it's taken time for folks to also realize, you know, the stories that we're hearing today and all the other stories that exist, people also just need this support as a human of just what I've lived through and what I continue to live through, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
some of the specific things they've asked for?
Yeah. So our support that we have for folks is we have things that you would think of like more traditional kind of therapy. We have that. But we also try to think of what is the type of support that might make most sense for people, because therapy is not what everybody needs nor wants. And actually kind of, you know, the same way that Maketh was just talking about with the caseworker, we try and think a lot about peer support. So that's a program that we have as well, as we have a lot of folks, actually in every department at our agency, are folks who have arrived here as refugees themselves or of other status from other places. And so they are trained in mental health first aid and trauma-informed care, and they can support folks who are feeling isolated, who are lacking confidence, who are feeling a lot of anxiety about navigating the city. So we have a lot of folks who can provide that type of peer one-on-one counseling. We also have specific support for families who have children ages 3 and under, just knowing how tender that time of development is. And for most of our families, they're now raising these kids without their community.
Wow.
So trying to build community in that way as well. And then just access to other pieces of healthcare that are really challenging. So we have an on-site dental clinic that operates mostly with volunteer dentists. So we're able to support folks that way. So we really just try and think really
kind of cover
flexibly
a lot
about it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a wide range. Maria, as you listen to that list there, I mean, tell us about some of the supports you needed back when you first arrived.
I believe the legal support was the most urgent to me as an immigrant seeking asylum. understanding the asylum process, seeking representation, and navigating a completely different legal system and a different culture, trying to find housing, mm-hmm. navigate the healthcare system, and something to that regard.
You work now for an immigrant advocacy association, as you mentioned earlier. What was the inspiration to do that work? Was it what you had been through?
Yes. I know what it feels to be voiceless and overwhelmed, particularly with the immigration system here and what other immigrants are actually facing, particularly with this current administration. And so I felt like I don't want others to go through that alone. And being an immigration attorney or providing immigration advocacy gave me that power to kind of like turn the pain that I have and I'm going through in this entire process I am having, and just trying to turn it into power and helping others, actually.
Yeah, that shows a lot of strength. Hina, you kind of gave us that breakdown earlier of sort of the differences here when we talk about displaced folks. The policy changes that we're talking about, the things that are coming from the White House, do they impact all displaced people equally, would you say? Like refugees and asylum seekers are all sort of dealing with the same...
Similar, right?
Blowbacks from these cuts?
Yeah, no, absolutely. They're very similar. I think, you know, some of the big things that are hitting hard is this freeze on, you know, becoming a green card holder, a lawful permanent resident. Mm-hmm. Right now, there's a lot of agencies and organizations advocating to get more information to see why are we stopping. You know, we've talked about this wonderful, we have programs like Refugee One, and we've heard from our two individuals here who've experienced it. We have all these support systems. We have things in place to help people. And, you know, as Americans, I think that's a part of our fabric. We want to keep people safe. And to say that, okay, we're not sure if you're going to progress in the legal pipeline and become a permanent resident is difficult. Refugees who are already here, there's a follow to join program for families. Like family reunification is a big part mm-hmm. of our immigration law.
But wasn't
and
there some cuts around
there's,
that
yeah, there's
too?
A freeze around that too. So that's kind of paused for now. So you're, you know, already the anguish of coming to this country, fleeing, you know, whatever atrocities you were, and now you're separated from your family. So
what do you do?
Right.
What are your options? What are your options? You know, we have been talking, Hina, about, you know, all of the new realities here, from cuts to just what life is like on a day-to-day. Tell me more about conversations that you're having with clients who are just concerned right now about their status. It's such an uncertain time. So I feel like, for starters, there's just confusion.
Yeah, there is a lot of confusion, and not just amongst, you know, legal advocates as well, right? We don't know what's going to happen next. I mean, I gave some examples of things that we saw that were unexpected, but I feel like there's new changes and new things we're hearing about every day. So being, you know, extremely vigilant for our clients and really digging into, is there anything in your history that the U.S. government could misunderstand, right, or misrepresent? And we're seeing that in Maria's case, where she's clearly still afraid of future persecution, and they're like, no, we don't believe you.
Right.
Right. So just to kind of be hyper vigilant to advocate for each client and each mm-hmm. individual stories and each family stories, right? We, you know, people don't want to leave their homes, and they're doing it, you know, despite what we're hearing from talking heads, through proper legal mechanisms, right? These are not easy things to come through.
But that's being overlooked.
It's completely being overlooked, making it look like they're, you know, coming here without the authority.
Just
to.
Showing up.
And that's not what's happening.
Not at all. Maketh, some of the stories that you're hearing from new arrivals that you come across, what do they say? And do they sound similar to what you went through years ago?
Yes. In July 4th, we have a reunion, and we were expecting to have 3,000 attendees.
Mm-hmm.
But less number show up because there was a fear if you go there might be some agency that will pop up during the conference.
You mean because of right now that heightened
yes.
awareness of ICE?
Yeah. So the people who just came to the country... it's better to be at home. If they show up at my door, I'm not in the wrong place. So that put people in a fear, like, okay, I have to avoid the gathering. Mm-hmm. But gathering are part of raising awareness, bringing people who are down up, because if we cannot help ourselves who are given an opportunity, who will help those who just came into the country?
So, and you're helping people who came from Sudan?
Yes.
Like you did?
Yes.
Tell me more about the specific help you're providing.
Like connect them to the job. I am very fortunate to work at the Hyatt, that the company that opened a door for me.
Mm-hmm. Hyatt?
Yes. That company gave me my opportunity and work my way up. Now I'm a manager at the company. And I remember one of the refugees guy came from East Africa. He have a family of four. He came in for a job interview. I was lucky I was there with my manager on the side.
Mm-hmm.
The guy don't even speak enough English, but he really want a job. So he came with a family photo and showed it to me and start crying.
Wow.
So me, I have a connection with him. I took the family photo from him and gave him a napkin. And I say, it's okay. But he was communicating in his own way, showing that I really need a job for my family.
Wow.
So wow. I told my boss that family that he's showing us is to show that he wants a job for a family. So now it's up to us. But for me, I failed because that was me when I came here 20 years ago. So I have that connection. So connecting people now because of the job that we've been holding it for so long, it's easy for those people who are coming now to get connected.
Yeah. Maya, you know, we're hearing these stories from Maria and from Maketh. I mean, is this something that you see today about folks coming here and then sort of becoming volunteers or just dedicating their time to sort of, to give back?
Yeah.
And absolutely. Support new arrivals.
Absolutely. We see it a lot. Whether it's volunteering, it's our staff. I think people feel this human pull to be there for other people, especially when they have felt supported. And so we're seeing that so much. We're seeing it even more so now. I think the last 6 months, we're getting more people reaching to us.
Well, these policies are brutal. They're brutal, what we're talking about, all these cuts. But I wonder, have we seen this before?
Like
American attitudes toward refugees, have they always been empathetic? Before this?
Yeah, I think it's changed over time. I think it's certainly not a brand new thing. I think what feels different now is how empowered folks are being. I think from the most powerful people in our country saying that it is okay to have these really harmful and xenophobic beliefs that are often based in made up things and things that aren't true. And so I think what we're seeing is folks who are feeling just much more empowered to say things out loud. And maybe folks before who weren't as involved are also now believing stories and saying that and treating people in a different way. But certainly we know that the way that folks are received here, I think we've heard from people here talk about support they got and how they were received.
Mm-hmm.
So the welcome that people get plays a huge role in how somebody's experience goes here and how it starts.
Hina, you've been working with people like Maria, right? I wonder how that's changed things for you. Like, how are you doing?
I love that you're asking me.
How often do you get that question?
Yeah, I don't. And I haven't really had time to think about this. But I definitely feel challenged, right? Because these are times where we really have to look to our laws and make sure they're being upheld by the people who are supposed to uphold them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other piece is I feel hopeful, right? I'm even in this interview, you know, we're hearing the stories of Maketh and Maria and the work that you do, Maya, right? That brings me hope in all the other legal advocates and organizations who are speaking up. And making sure that the sentiment doesn't completely change, right? That because I think I'm hoping that what we're hearing on that surface level at xenophobia and being okay to talk about it is not how the majority of Americans feel. And I have to believe that as an American, right? And what I hold true and the humanitarian values that our country was built on and the laws that exist to protect one another. So I think I'm doing my best to keep my head up and be hopeful that there are so many others who want change and make sure we don't go down this ugly road that we're seeing ourselves on.
Maketh, are you also hopeful? I mean, we're seeing, as we've described, this experience seems to have drawn while it's all, you know, while the storm is happening, it's drawn this community of advocates and volunteers closer together. People are looking out for each other. Does that give you hope?
Yes. At the church, I'm getting so many emails through our mailbox. People reaching out to us to see what need are we looking at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing that support coming from people who don't even know us,
yes,
it gives us a hope that this is America that we join, and this is the society that we need to raise people who are just welcoming to this country.
Mm-hmm.
So the hope is there. I don't know when it's going to change, but it's really there, and we cannot give up, especially those who started from that ground level.
Right.
We are the one who need to be on the front line.
Absolutely.
Just helping those people who are here so that they can be here. I'm here because somebody was picking me on the ground. Somebody, yes, was giving the resource.
Somebody took a chance on me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Maria, last word to you. Uncertainty right now. You're in this waiting period where you're going to rebut a decision that's come down from the government. What's next for you?
It is actually hard for me, just planning for my future. It's hard to plan for your future when you feel like your life is on a pause. And so I have learned how to live in uncertainty and make like short-term goals. However, I still actually have hope, and I'm grateful for the community support and the legal advocates and the community individuals like Hina, was, yeah, just such a wonderful advocate for me and others. So I have hope, and I will continue to fight.
Yes.
Never give up. Yeah.
Yeah. We've been talking with Maria, who's an asylum seeker from Syria, Hina Musabji, who's a legal director at CARE Chicago, Maya Oyarbi Sanchez, who's a wellness director at Refugee One Chicago, and Maketh Mobiar, who's one of the leaders of the Sudanese congregation at St. Paul's by the Lake Church here in Chicago. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for having us.
This episode was produced and mixed by Sienna Greaves. It was edited by Meha Ahmed. This concludes our series on understanding more deeply what it means to live and work as an immigrant in Chicago. We dug into the experiences of local green card holders, international students, people here working on skilled worker visas, and people seeking asylum. You can check out the full series at wbez.org/reset. Thanks so much for listening. We'll meet again soon.